I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 9th of September. Our guest this hour wrote a piece in the New York Times opinion section on September 1st, and he said this. Last month, College Board released a revised curriculum framework to help high school teachers prepare students for the advanced placement test in U.S. history. Like the college courses, the test is supposed to mirror. The AP course calls for a dialogue with the past, learning how to ask historical questions, interpret documents, and reflect both appreciatively and critically on history. It navigates the tension, or navigating the tension, between patriotic inspiration and historical thinking, between respectful veneration and critical engagement, is an especially difficult task, made even more complicated by a marked shift in the very composition of We the People. Joining us this hour is Jim Grossman, Executive Director of the American Historical Association. How we teach history is what we're talking about this hour. From 97 until 2010, Jim was Vice President for Research and Education at the Newberry Library. He's taught graduate courses at the University of Chicago, received his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, has also taught at University of California, San Diego, and has written a number of books, including Land of Hope, Chicago, Black Southerners, and the Great Migration, and A Chance to Make Good, African Americans, 1900 to 1929. He's been a consultant to many history-related projects by the BBC, Smithsonian, and various theater companies, filmmakers, museums, and libraries. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour, asking you how you learned history. Has there been a significant change in the way we learn history compared to how our grandparents learned history? And is this all rightfully a matter of some controversy? We welcome phone calls at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Jim Grossman, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for the invitation.
Yeah, our pleasure. Well, Mom always said in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and I have to think that's probably the way that she learned history, and that maybe even I learned history for a little while in my life. We learned names, dates, and we learned facts.
That's right, and it's still important to learn names, to learn dates, and to learn facts. But what I think we've learned, and it's not just historians, cognitive psychologists, education professionals over the last generation have come to realize that it's much more important for people to learn how to think than to memorize a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can always find the information. And so you need to have enough of the names, dates, and facts to have context. You're going to have trouble if you don't know when the Civil War happened or if you don't know what the American Revolution was. But the portable skill is how to think historically and how to think critically. Once you have that, that's like a tree that you can hang anything on.
And
that's what's changed.
And the whole composition of We the People, as you note in your article in the New York Times, has changed. And this seems really significant to me. This fall, you write, whites will constitute a minority of public school students in the U.S., which makes our past, really, and that which we need to study, much more diverse, right?
Well, yes, that's actually been one of the interesting controversial pieces, aspects of that piece. And a lot of people, I think justifiably, have said, well, it doesn't matter who's in the seats in the classroom. The history is the history. And that is true. You don't say, well, just because there's a certain type of person in my class, I'm going to teach something that's going to cater necessarily to that person's sense of identity. But on the other hand, we do know that people are more likely to engage something that they feel has something to do with them. But also, if we are to understand the past as the culture that has emerged in the United States, the culture that has emerged in the United States is a culture that has come from many different places.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it. And also a lot of it is, what is it that we want our children to learn as citizens? Because even people – what's interesting is the controversy over the test, over the AP framework – generally, everybody pretty much agrees that part of the goal of learning history is to learn to be a good citizen. And part of learning to be a good citizen is to appreciate the diversity of your community and of your neighborhood.
Well, tell us more. You talk a little bit in the opinion piece about the way that we used to teach the plantations as a kind of school, and what happened when people left the plantations at too early a stage in their lives, perhaps. What a different way to teach that chapter of American history.
Well, I gave that actually as an example. I think, as you know, and I'm sure most of your listeners know, the word revisionism has become a sort of a dirty word in public culture, that when someone wants to say that Joe Smith lied, they'll say, well, Joe Smith is doing revisionist history. It's become a synonym for not telling the truth. And actually, that's not what revisionism is about. Revisionism is, I use the example in the piece about you wouldn't want to go to a doctor who's not reading revisionist medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Revisionism is about we keep learning. And as we learn, we change the stories that we tell. We benefit from the new knowledge, whether it's in history, from new documents, new ways of thinking. And slavery is the perfect example. Up until the 1950s, the dominant narrative that was taught in the schools, the dominant narrative that most people thought, was that slavery was unfortunate but not such a bad thing, enslaved Americans were people who came from inferior cultures. They were westernized on the plantation. This benefited them. And that, in fact, they would have been better off had they been emancipated later after they had become, quote, fully civilized. And this is the classic works in Southern history. Up until the 1950s, this was the story. The only one really who told a different story between about 1900 and 1956 was W.E.B. Du Bois, an African-American scholar who not many white folks read. And then in 1956, a fellow named Kenneth Stamp, who actually I believe was trained at the University of Wisconsin, his Ph.D. from the University of Wisconsin, wrote a book called The Peculiar Institution, where he said, no, slavery was primarily a labor system, mm-hmm. and that's what it was about. And in the 50 years since then, we've completely changed the way we think about the plantation, about slavery, and that's revisionism. That's an example.
Yeah, it's a shocking example to think that that's what was taught as recently as 1950s, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And you can go topic after topic and see how something was taught a certain way for a while. And then new documents were either found or there were documents that people hadn't thought of using. In the case of slavery, there was nothing, including Stamp, actually, that tried to understand slavery from the perspective of slaves, how slaves experienced it, because everybody assumed that you couldn't do that. It was illegal to teach slaves how to read and write, so therefore they wouldn't have left any documents. And then people began to realize, well, wait a second, the federal government, the WPA, as part of the Federal Writers Project, interviewed thousands of ex-slaves in the 1930s. And there were volumes and volumes of this stuff. And that if you read it a certain way, the sources had a problem. These were very old people being interviewed. They were being interviewed during the Great Depression, which shaped the way they thought about the past. But if you used the documents in a certain way, you could actually get windows into the perspective of slaves on their experience as enslaved people. So part of it is sometimes we just realize, oh, there are documents.
Mm-hmm.
When I wrote my first book, in fact, on the migration of black Southerners to the North, I was told by many people, you can't write that book the way you want to write it because you can't write the book from their perspective. There aren't any sources. And my advisor, who actually had once taught at the University of Wisconsin, helped me to understand that there were ways in which you could read things to glean those perspectives. So sometimes it's we find new sources through archaeology, through the discovery of sets of papers that nobody knew about were in someone's attic, and sometimes we learn how to read things in different ways or mm-hmm. ask different questions.
So this idea of reading primary sources is relatively new, Jim?
No, historians have been reading primary sources since time immemorial. I think what's relatively new is, and I say relatively new, it's a couple generations, is emphasizing the reading of primary sources by students.
I see.
And again, it's not that new. It's, you know, 50 years easily. Mm-hmm. But the notion that instead of saying to students, here's a textbook, this textbook will tell you a story, and that story is correct. Instead, say, here's some primary sources. We're going to give you enough context for you to be able to understand these primary sources, and now you figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean that every – often what people think is that what that means is that one narrative is just as good as another. Well, that's your opinion, and this is my opinion, and we've both read the primary sources. But what the word discipline means in the academy is that there are certain standards, there are certain rules for the way we read evidence. And we do know that some narratives are more compelling than others, simply because we do look at evidence, we do consider evidence, and if someone says, well, this is what happened, and I could then say, okay, but that can't possibly account for X, Y, or Z, which we know also happened afterwards, then that's a problem with that narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So we have ways of determining, well, which narratives are more compelling than others. Do they comport with the evidence?
So let's move to all of the brouhaha concerning the College Board revised
yeah.
curriculum framework. You talk about the Texas State Board of Education accusing the College Board of promoting among our students a disdain for American principles and a lack of knowledge of major American achievements. What are they concerned about?
My sense is that they are concerned that the and I'm sure some of your listeners might well express this more articulately, more cogently, because they might agree with that position. But my sense is that what they're saying is that the new framework does not place enough emphasis on heroic events, on important iconic documents, Constitution, Declaration of Independence, heroic deeds on progress, on how the United States has been a force for international progress. My sense is that's the problem that they have. And if you look at the framework, it's actually not true. There's a nice piece at in the early period that the framework covers, where it talks about, in fact, the United States as a democratic experiment. It makes it very clear that the kind of democracy that was being established was new, and that people in other parts of the world, in France, in Haiti, tried to imitate it. But there is, it's no longer exclusively that story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the problem. The story, if you go back to a textbook from the 1950s, what you're going to get is mostly a very comfortable narrative. Doesn't talk much about slavery, doesn't talk much about the slave trade, it doesn't talk, there was a historian, Richard Hofstadter,
mm-hmm.
who, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, but in the beginning of one of his books he said, America is a nation that was born in perfection and aspired to progress. And that was a critique. He was criticizing that narrative. But that's what was the general narrative at the time Hofstadter wrote that in the 1950s, that everything was great, and then there's a story of progress. It's like new and improved tide.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a certain amount of discomfort when we say, well, no. There were things back there that weren't very good. There were times when the United States did things that did not comport with the values that we have put forward as a nation, very admirable values. So, yes, it is important that we talk about the camps that Japanese Americans were forced into during World War II. That's an important aspect
sure.
of World War II. It's
right.
not one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's where the objections lie, but I'd rather hear your listeners express the objections than my try to me try to articulate them.
All right. Well, maybe they will. Maybe they won't. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe they'll agree with you. We'll
But those were the objections that I was trying to respond to, was the concern that was expressed that the founding documents were being downplayed, that the new framework put the United States in a negative light, that students wouldn't learn enough about presidents, about the sort of the great affairs of the country. And that's in part because the framework does include more about the mundane lives of everyday Americans.
Jim Grossman is our guest this hour, executive director of the American Historical Association. He wrote an opinion piece on September 1st in the New York Times that caught our attention, and it's about history and how history is taught and the controversy that has been surrounding the College Board revised curriculum framework that will help high school teachers prepare students for the advanced placement test in U.S. history. There's been a change, and you've heard Jim carefully outline a marked change in the way that we teach history. There's a marked change in who we the people are in this country. It's quite a change. And there has been some concern that some of these recommendations or this revised curriculum is emphasizing negative aspects of our history rather than the positive aspects of our history. And it's also designed to make students critical thinkers about history, asking important questions, how to ask important historical questions, and how to interpret documents. Would you agree? Some of you probably are teaching history, or you recently took a course in history, or you're very interested and have been following this story. We would love to hear from you. And here's how you call us. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. On Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Jim Grossman, Executive Director of the American Historical Association, and we'll start with Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I very much agree with your guest there. And once upon a time back in the mid-late 60s, I actually taught history. And American history has this, at that time anyway, had this pattern to it of teaching how our founders were basically could do no wrong. They were brilliant, every one of them, and they were good and honest and pure and true. The whole George Washington, you know, and the cherry tree type thing, and that was the image. And it occurred to me at the time, as I was presenting this material, that, you know, the people who are being most deserved by this are the politicians that we have today, because how on earth can you ever live up to that? You know, we put them up on this pedestal, we make them into these divine beings, and then we go out to the next election and say, okay, which one of you candidates is going to be the next George Washington or
right,
or Thomas Jefferson? And I just think that if we had more our kids were taught more of a sense of, I mean, because I think the story is much more interesting when you really read the facts about these folks anyway. I mean, in the real lives rather than the sanitized version, and you come away with a real appreciation and you think, yeah, these were people who had egos and had problems and had all this other thing, and they still came up with something that worked pretty well for them.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the people we have running now, maybe one or two of them can get by their flaws and do something decent.
Thank you, Scott. Jim?
I think that's right. To suggest that to create cardboard heroic characters does a disservice to the rest of us who must live with our imperfections. And it's not only the issue of their individual imperfections, which we all have, but it's also, if we're going to understand, whether it's the Founding Fathers or anybody else, we have to understand how they sat in relation to other Americans, how they sat in systems of what we call social relations. And quite frankly, this is where I think the rubber hits the road with some of the conflict over this, which is many of the critics of the framework are also critical of historians for overemphasizing race, class, and gender. And I think Jefferson and Washington are good examples. But all the founding, if you want to understand their worldview, you have to understand the fact that they own slaves. That's part of their worldview. Part of their understanding of themselves was the concept of mastery. There's a wonderful, again, a primary autobiography of Landon Carter, a Virginia slaveholder who was a contemporary of the founding fathers and a member of the one of the major families of the Virginia aristocracy. When you read his autobiography, you realize how obsessed he was with himself as a man, as a master, and a member of the Virginia ruling class. And that's not to say he's good or he's bad, but it's to say you can't possibly understand the ways in which these men saw the world and saw the ways in which people interacted without understanding how they understood men in relation to women, whites in relation to blacks, and the role of a ruling class. And again, it's not good or bad. It just was.
Thank you, Scott, very much for your call. Matt in Brookfield, hi.
Hi. Yes, I think we've done a good job of examining the different ways that historical knowledge is collected. And I agree that revision is sort of long overdue because we're just participating in this tradition of revision. And I feel like the narrative that people want to defend, specifically the types of people who might be on the Texas Board of Education, is sort of informed by this 1950s Walt Disney Presents kind of sort of jingoistic entertainment history that, as far as I can tell, is mostly informed by Beale's Boys Nickel Library, and is sort of the second generation of terrible history. And whether or not you think that America is getting a fair shake or not in the new pattern, it seems like, why would you defend that? Why is that the kind of history, the tradition of history that you want to defend, other than it's the one that you grew up with?
Jim.
I think that's a very good point. The one thing I would disagree with is I don't think revision is long overdue. Revision is continuous, and it happens all the time. And it happens all the time in medicine. It happens all the time in history. It happens all the time in literary criticism. I mean, you're going to have a show on literature after World War I. The way we read that literature is not the way we read it 30 years ago, which is not the way it was read 50 years
right.
ago. There's revisionism in physics. I mean, we all know there's constant revisionism in physics. So revisionism is a continuous process. It's not something that just suddenly happens. But I think this issue of being proud of the country, not because we're telling a story that's not true, but in fact being able to be proud of being an American, being proud of the United States, by looking at the ways in which we have dealt with various issues, it does make more sense. Why would one want to be proud of a nation whose story one has to falsify in order to be proud of it?
Mm-hmm.
And there are traditions, just like, I'm 62 years old. There are many aspects of my life that I'm not terribly proud of. There are many aspects of my life that I am. And what I hope I can be proud of is being willing to look back on my life and say, these are some mistakes that I've made, and I'm going to understand them, and I'm going to learn from them.
Mm-hmm. Well, somehow it seems to me, tell me if you think of this otherwise, that our sense of patriotism, the parades that we have, the way that we wave the flag, the way that we really can stifle dissent sometimes in this country, that we celebrate our patriotism without an understanding of the complexity, so that during the Vietnam protests, it was, you heard frequently, either love it or leave it. You have this thread of wanting to deny a complexity. For what reason? And it's tied into the way we celebrate America in many ways.
And even that needs to be historicized in the sense that it's not as if Vietnam was the first time that there was that kind of response to anti-war protest. So I think part of the problem that we have is that sometimes we think that something is new and threatening because we think it's new and threatening. And in fact, it's not new at all. The people who thought that anti-war protests during the Vietnam War were basically going to spell the end of the Republic as we know it were mostly unaware of the extent of anti-war activity there was during World War One.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the amount of opposition there was to the War of 1812, which was quite considerable. So we have managed to live through significant opposition to wars in which the country has participated and come out the other side quite well. And arguably, it's the opposition to the war that often helps us to come out the other side quite well because it means that we've had a healthier debate in our society about the direction of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it. And in the 50s, the dominant strain of history was called consensus history. There was a sense that Americans had pretty much agreed on everything for 200 years. And once we realized that that wasn't true, we became more comfortable with conflict. That's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Matt, very much for the call. We go to John. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655, and you would be able to get through. Our lines have been busy. Hello, John in Milwaukee.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Could I recommend that we not rely on too much on the churches, schools, and Hollywood for our history, and that because today you've got YouTube and the Internet in which you can constantly find different points of view on what happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're much better served there because you don't have a people that are self-interested. They present the history in the schools, in the churches, et cetera, in Hollywood, according to what serves the people that are making the narrative. And you don't have have a choice there. But in on YouTube and on the Internet, you've got an enormous variety of ideas of what really happened in the past, and that's the place to go for knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Jim, you agree?
There's good history in lots of places, and there's bad history in lots of places. And you will find a lot of garbage coming out of Hollywood. You'll find a lot of good work coming out of Hollywood. You'll find a lot of garbage on the Internet, and you'll find a lot of good work on the Internet. So what we want to teach our students is how to separate what's good and what's garbage. We want them to learn how to think critically, how to think historically, so that no matter where they're getting their history, they can scratch their head and say, wait a second, the evidence doesn't really work here.
Thank you, John, for your call. Jack in Door County, hi.
This is Jack. I agree with the last comment. I'm a retired college science teacher, and I'm very concerned that Texas school board is trying to kill the college board, and they're setting up exams and things, just like they're trying to kill science, the way science is taught. And keep in mind that the textbooks that are used in the elementary, secondary, and high schools, most of them are written because according to the Texas board, because they have the big market. And so all of our students are going to be learning that, and the students are not going to have a chance to learn how to analyze things. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Jack.
I think that's, in a sense, that relates to the previous comment in terms of where we get our knowledge, whether it's science or history. And you can find good work all over the place, and you can find bad work all over the place. And the question is, I think, for the average American, how do I know what's good? How do I know whether something is reliable? And what I would strongly recommend in any area of the humanities, history, literature, philosophy, is the National Endowment for the Humanities has a site called EdCitement, EdCitement. And what they've done is they've very carefully vetted educational websites.
Oh, really? Oh.
Relating to the humanities. And if you go to the National Endowment for the Humanities website and look for EdCitement, or just Google EdCitement, you'll find it. And you'll find a very good list of places where you get good history. And you could also go to History Matters at George Mason University, which had a federal contract from the Department of Education to pull together the Teaching American History program. There's a lot of places that come out of universities, come out of the National Endowment for the Humanities, where you can get, where you, I think, can be certain that stuff is pretty reliable. People complain about the peer review system in academia. It's not perfect, but it is the best system that we know, which is that work that has been peer reviewed generally has been looked at for rules of evidence, for rules of argument and historical thinking, for standards.
Let's talk about what happens in classroom. You've got this framework that we talked about.
Yeah.
But when it comes to what happens within a classroom, you also say that the curriculum content will still remain the province of the teacher,
yes,
the school district, and the state.
Yes.
So how do you frame what's within your classroom according with what will serve your students best when they're taking the AP history test?
Well, I what I would encourage everybody who is interested in this problem to do, this is the typical professorial strategy, which tactic, which is you tell people to go and do the reading. It's unfortunate, and I apologize, but
no,
I would advise
fine.
People to go and do the reading.
Before
you criticize the framework, read the framework. And before you criticize the framework also, they've now released a sample exam. And when you look at the sample exam, you see that it can accommodate a lot of different ways for teachers to approach the material. And so, and the other thing that, that people should do, by the way, is Google APUSH, APUSH, which is APUS History, and then the name of any person or event that you think is important. And what you'll do is you will find actual syllabi.
Really?
From teachers and schools that are online. Sure. If the Madison public schools have any of their syllabi online, and some public schools do and some public schools don't, but if the schools have their syllabi online and it's the AP U.S. History course, you can simply Google AP U.S. History or APUSH, and then whatever topic you think is important, and it'll pop up and you'll see that teachers are teaching about James Madison. They are teaching about Martin Luther King. What the framework does is the framework gives teachers a way of putting these specific things into a historical context and into the context of thinking historically. And so teachers can use a variety of different examples. And if you look at the sample exam, actually, one of the questions asks the students to compare two different ways of thinking about the frontier. One of them, a very fairly contemporary, quote, revisionist perspective on the frontier. And the other one, the very famous Frederick Jackson Turner of University of Wisconsin fame, from the end of the 19th century, who had a very different sense of what the frontier was about. So what the teachers are doing are using materials that they think make sense to fit within this framework. And so what the framework does is it does push teachers to include things they might not have otherwise included. You can no longer just teach the political narrative. Your students won't be prepared.
Jim Grossman is our guest this hour. He's executive director of the American Historical Association and wrote a piece in the New York Times on September 1st. If we want students to understand what's happening in Missouri or the Middle East, they need an unvarnished picture of our past and the skills to understand and interpret that picture. He goes on to talk about the College Board releasing a revised curriculum framework that will help high school teachers get students ready for the advanced placement test in United States history, or really to get everybody ready for the best way to learn history. It has been controversial. Basically, this isn't doing it complete justice because it provides a more meaty view of American history. Everything isn't all positive because history isn't all rosy and happy. And what we've done and who we are has been problematic and complicated at times. So it has created some controversy, and we're talking about that, the best way to teach history. And we're doing that with Jim. Jim, as I said, was executive director of the American Historical Association. He's also written some history books, Land of Hope, Chicago Black Southerners and the Great Migration, and A Chance to Make Good, African Americans, 1900 to 1929. He has taught at many universities, and we're happy to have him with us. Just giving us these website addresses is good, isn't it? What a wealth of information this guest is. More phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation. Do you find that these recommendations are controversial? How did you learn history? What is the best way to learn history? How do we change our minds? How long does it take to have a historical record? I want to ask him that. How many years do we need to give a presidential administration to determine historically whether or not it was a valuable one or a problematic one? 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up later this month, we're having a lovely event that I'd like to invite you to. You can have dinner and bid on silent auction items that feature Packers tickets, Harley-Davidson gear. You can play WPR trivia, meet Larry Mueller and me, KP, many other people who work here at Wisconsin Public Radio. And at the end of the night, I'll be giving you an insider's view of public radio with a talk that looks back on my more than 10,000 interviews with Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Thursday, September 25 in the Milwaukee area, and you can register at WPR.org/Milwaukee. That's WPR.org/Milwaukee. Let's go back to phone calls and Laura in Green Bay. Hi, Laura.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I'm a retired teacher, English, and I graduated from college in 1972, and I thought all these problems with ignoring minorities were all straightened out by then. But what I found, and this was in the late 90s, that if you speak of such things, you will often be labeled a liberal, and you will be up against parents and administrators who fear the parents, and you may as well bring your own crucifix.
My goodness. Jim?
Well, I try not to carry a crucifix around with me, but I think that's probably true in parts of the country. I was very fortunate to have grown up in a school district that was integrated, and so I think I got history that was a little better than I think a lot of what other people my age got in the 1960s. But I do think that is apparently still true, unfortunately, that the nation is becoming a different place from where it was 50 years ago. And people who are uncomfortable with that are uncomfortable with a history that helps us to understand how this change happened. And I don't like to impute intention to people. And so I am a little reluctant to say, well, this is why people oppose this. People have very honest reasons for opposing this. But I do think some of the opposition does come from a concern that things are changing and not necessarily for the better.
Hmm. Where did you grow up, Jim?
Outside of New York City, just north of Yonkers, town of Greenberg.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Laura, for your call. Charles in Madison is next. Hi, Charles.
Hi. Jim, it's Chuck Cohen. You'll remember me, I hope.
Hi, Chuck.
I teach history here, and I founded the AP Institute at UW-Madison. I just want to say for over 20 years, the university has been leading in developing curricula for high school teachers, and it goes on now that I've retired from that. I think the changes to the exam in general are very, very good. I just wanted to ask Jim what he thought in general of the national opinion expressed by politicians and pundits and regular folks that the humanities are essentially worthless because they don't fit into a consumer model of education.
In 30 seconds or less, huh, Chuck?
We'll give you more than 30 seconds.
You give me 30 seconds. Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm not sure how many politicians are saying that. I suspect that it's easier to get publicity by saying that. But I think it's a lack of understanding as to what the humanities contribute, not just to public life, but even to, quite frankly, people's careers. We know, as much as politicians may be saying that, we also know that that business leaders say that, especially for people who are going to rise to positions of leadership, they want people who have studied the humanities. They want liberal arts graduates with the humanities background. Again, to pick an example of an alumnus of the University of Wisconsin, John Rowe, the recently retired chief executive of Exelon Corporation, was a history major. Who founded a charter school in Chicago where he teaches history now, and he will tell you that that leadership roles in the private sector as well as in government, the best training is a liberal education with a strong dose of the humanities. Mm-hmm. And so the notion that humanities education does not prepare you to do something worthwhile, to do something valuable, is just silly. I think the other thing that the reason I have a problem there is that a lot of the argument that Chuck is describing is based upon studies that are using income data to demonstrate the value of a particular major. So history majors or English majors or philosophy majors earn less money, especially in the short run, than, say, engineers. And I say that my daughter is studying to be an engineer, so it's not a prejudice against engineers. What that assumes is that engineers are more valuable to our society than clergymen, elementary school teachers, because many people in the humanities go into occupations that are not well paid but are extremely valuable. So what I'm opposed to is using as a determinant of the value of someone's education the amount of money that they earn.
Mm-hmm.
That does not describe what they contribute to our community.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, case in point, and thank you, Charles, very much for calling and for listening. This afternoon, the president is meeting with people in the administration and people who are experts on the Middle East, on terrorism, on ISIS, on Syria, on Saudi Arabia, etc. We find ourselves here doing talk shows that are related to what's going on in the news. And I must tell you, Jim, that when it came to understanding Afghanistan, everybody was scrambling to find, you know, a handful of experts on this particular country when that war started. I remember when we were doing shows then, and the case in point today, too, that we're looking for, actively looking for people who understand the history, for heaven's sake, of the Middle East, because it is so darn important to us right now. It's just crucial.
Well, I think this is something that people underestimate, which is that I would argue that actually every State Department desk should have a historian. Every corporation that invests in a foreign country should have a historian. How can you the number of American corporations that have been working in the Middle East over the last half century and the number of people who have had influence on American foreign policy, who barely knew the difference between a Sunni and a Shia, if they knew it at all,
right,
is astounding.
Right, I know.
And so what people forget is that everything has a history. There is nothing that does not have a history. And there is nothing that exists now that did not evolve in a historical context.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, for example, one easy example is we have people talk about repealing regulations without understanding why the regulation exists in the first place.
Right. Right.
So, yes, I think I would argue that the more – obviously this is self-interested, but, yes, the more historical thinking we have, the better off our policymaking will be.
Thank you, Charles, for your call. This Facebook comment, ironically, this comes as I'm finishing up an assignment where I've had to critique a large publishing house's set of social studies textbooks. Sadly, they are filled not only with factual inaccuracies, but also blind patriotism. Also, from an educational standpoint, the questions that are asked of students, as well as the ones suggested so that students may further students' learning, only involve lower-level thinking skills. It is depressing! Exclamation point.
No, blind anything is depressing. I mean, not in terms of people's abilities. I mean, in terms of knowledge, in terms of the. And any time we look at anything in the past with blinders on, with an inability to try to understand the context, makes no sense at all, and it's unfortunate. The reference to lower level skills, lower order skills, goes back to actually your very early question about the difference between memorization and historical thinking. And in whatever discipline you're working, memorization is considered to be a fairly lower level aspect of knowledge. We want to teach people how to think. And considering especially how sophisticated the internet is, it's pretty easy to go out there and get facts, basic facts, when something happened, who somebody was.
Mm-hmm.
It's teaching people what to do with it. And with history, in some ways, it's even thinking not about what the history is that we learn, but why do we learn it in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question I want every teacher to start with. Not what should I teach, what history should I teach, but start by looking at those people in the classroom and saying, why do these students need to learn history?
It's a good question. Yeah. Tom in Mequonico is next. Hi, Tom.
Well, good afternoon. This is a great topic. To be clear, I'm not a history teacher, but I am a big student of history. I like to study history. And one thing I've always wondered in the teaching of history, what might be a good idea is to at least at one time in secondary education or whatever, is to kind of teach history backwards, to go from what's happening today and teach it backwards and see how the connections are made. And Kathleen, it's a perfect point, is like what's happening in the Middle East really goes back to World War One, where we had France and Britain making the country of Iraq. And I think to teach it that way would also give the student, you know, a real appreciation of why things happen and why they're happening in the way they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting idea. Jim, almost out of time. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, and actually I've gotten a few letters about that after this piece. I actually think teaching history backwards is a problem. And the reason is that if you want to understand why something happens, and if you don't want to judge people unfairly, and this goes back to positive and negative, if you want to not judge George Washington by our standards but by his, you can't teach it backwards. You have to situate yourself at the point in time when decisions are being made. If you want to understand the New Deal, you've got to sit there in 1932 and 1933 and say, okay, what did these people see? What did they see? What did they know? They don't know what we know. Now, you do want to look forwards to watch and see how something turned out. But I think if you go backwards, the other problem is you also get a sense that something was inevitable, that something had to happen, because you're starting from what happened and you're working backwards from it. And actually, history is what we call, it's contingent. You don't know what's going to happen next when you make decisions.
Yeah, and on that, we have to say goodbye. Jim, thank you. Really interesting hour, and thanks for all the web recommendations as well.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Jim Grossman, Executive Director of the American Historical Association, his piece in the New York Times, we will put on our Facebook page if you'd like to read it in its entirety, which of course would be a very good thing to do. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and to KP as well for on-air production. Tomorrow, during this time period, we will be talking about ISIS and anticipating the president's address to the nation tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Thanks for listening to this hour. News coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with Clarence page.